weeks of 3-day military exercises and a massive stretch of water from the Strait of Hormuz toward the north of the Indian Ocean. Iran reacts to the attempted assassination of the Iraqi Prime Minister, saying it's a new sedition that can be traced back to foreign think tanks. And also Gaza rally in solidarity with Palestinian inmates who are on hunger strike in Israeli jails. We'll have a report for you. Good to have you with us. The top story this hour, the Iranian army is staging a massive maneuver in the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. The military drills are aimed at boosting coordination among the four branches of the Iranian military. Yusuf Janani is there.
A full-scale war in the Strait of Hormuz, the Sea of Oman, and north of the Indian Ocean has engaged the Iranian army's navy, air force, air defense, and ground force. This is the scenario of a large-scale military exercise dubbed Zulfaqar 1400. Conducted over a million square kilometer area, the maneuver saw the use of domestically built sea-launched cruise missiles, air-to-surface missiles, and submarines.
The main objective of the drill is to prove that we can stand on our feet and ensure the security of our country and the region. Our message to the foreign forces is that we don't need you here in our region, and regional states have the capability to guarantee their own security.
The 3-day drill also involved the latest domestically built drones, such as Simorgh and Mohajer 4, which conducted reconnaissance and combat operations against mock enemy vessels. Iranian military officials say they owe the country's capabilities in indigenizing the defense industry to 4 decades of U.S. arms embargoes that have blocked Iran's access to international defense equipment.
All of the equipment used in the drill, especially those that belong to the Navy, are produced domestically by our experts. Today we successfully tested some of the latest ones in the military exercise, and this shows that with or without U.S. arms sanctions, Iran's borders are safe with our homegrown weapons.
The Army says the drill aims to test the country's indigenously built equipment and to improve its prowess in safeguarding its territorial waters amid heightened tensions in the region, which recently saw Iran showing the footage of its commandos thwarting an attempt by the U.S. Navy to seize an Iranian oil tanker in the Sea of Oman.
One of the major goals of this maneuver is to boost synergy and coordination between the four branches of the Iranian Army. A goal which the Army says is not a threat to any country, but a contributor to peace and security in a region that's rife with piracy and extraterritorial threats. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi says he's unhurt after a drone attack targeted his residence in Baghdad's Green Zone.
Thank God, me and those who worked with me are in good health. Your heroic security and military forces are working on maintaining Iraq's stability and protection. The cowardly missiles and the cowardly drones do not build our nation and do not build our future. We are working on building our nation, on respecting the state and its establishments, securing better future for all Iraqis.
Khatami called on Iraqi citizens to remain calm and maintain peaceful dialogue for the sake of the country and future. The attack has injured several members of his personal protection team. Iraq has seen some turmoil following last month's general elections. There have been protests over the election results. The latest rallies in Baghdad just 2 days ago turned out of control, and one person got killed. Following that, Khatami ordered a committee to investigate the violence. There has been no claim of responsibility for the attack on the premier's house. The Iraqi military is saying it was an attempt to assassinate the official. Let's stay with the story about the failed attempt on the life of the Iraqi prime minister. Reactions from different groups and officials in the country are now coming in. Asad al-Haq, a movement affiliated with a popular mobilization unit, says it had warned recently that elements linked to certain intelligence officials were planning to conduct a false flag attack on Baghdad's Green Zone and blame it on resistance groups. The movement chief, Qais Ghazali, is calling for perpetrators to be identified and prosecuted. President Barham Saleh also called the attempted assassination a heinous crime against Iraq. Cleric Muqtada al-Sadr of his party won a majority in the October parliamentary vote, has called the attack an act of terrorism against Iraq and its people. And in neighboring Iran, Secretary of Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, has weighed in. He says the attack can be traced back to foreign think tanks creating and advocating terrorist groups in Iraq, as well as foreign invading powers. We've also asked Baghdad Bureau Chief Navid Behrouz to put the situation into some context for us, and he regards the attack as a possible effort to drive a wedge among political factions in Iraq.
Some people say that this attack is aimed at covering up on the violence during the protests, and they are people who would like to drive a wedge between political groups and the people. And actually, Mr. Shamkhani also said, the target was to create a new sedition in Iraq. And that was the aim, and they want to those behind this attack, that they were, as he said, could be traced back to foreign think tanks, as Mr. Shamkhani said, and they are the masterminds behind this. So we have had different reactions to this so far.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a protest rally in front of the Red Cross office in solidarity with inmates who are on a hunger strike for more than 100 days. Ruba Shabat has the story.
The prisoners' committee in the Gaza Strip held a rally in front of the Red Cross headquarters for the fourth consecutive day, protesting the Israeli illegal administrative detention policy practiced against Palestinian prisoners. This is part of a series of events held in the Gaza Strip in support of the prisoners whose health condition is deteriorating day by day due to the open-ended hunger strike.
We are here to send this clear message to our brothers and sisters in Israeli jails that we are proud of them for their resistance. There must be an end to their suffering. They have endangered their lives for the Palestinian cause, and now it is our duty to stand by them.
The protest comes as an Israeli court has reactivated its administrative detention order against Palestinian prisoner Miqdad al-Qawasmi, who has been on a hunger strike for over 100 days.
We hold Israel accountable for the lives of our inmates. The resistance front is closely monitoring the situation. Israel will pay a heavy price for its brutal behavior. The international community must be committed to its duties before it's too late.
In October, Qawasmi was admitted to the intensive care unit in Kaplan Medical Center following a deterioration in his health condition. The Israeli regime transferred him to a prison clinic, submitting false reports about his health conditions. At present, around 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are reportedly held in Israeli jails, including 200 children and 36 women. Of that number, 500 prisoners are in administrative detention. The policy of administrative detention allows Israeli authorities to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial. Al-Qawasmi's health has been deteriorating as he is on the edge of death. However, the Israeli court has renewed his administrative detention with no charge. Six more Palestinian inmates are on hunger strike inside Israeli jails, suffering a critical health condition amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shabat, Gaza.
Israeli Prime Minister says that the regime would oppose the reopening of the U.S. consulate for Palestinians in Al-Quds.
There's so much more we agree upon with our American friends than we disagree upon, but indeed, our position is, and it was presented very clearly and openly to our American friends, that there's no room for another American consulate in in Jerusalem.
Naftali Bennett suggested that such a mission should be opened elsewhere in the occupied West Bank. The consulate was shut and merged with the U.S. Embassy under former President Trump in 2018. The Trump administration also recognized Al-Quds as Israel's capital and relocated the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to the illegally annexed city. That sparked outrage among Palestinians who deem Al-Quds the capital of their future state. Yemen slammed Saudi Arabia for its refusal to allow ships carrying fuel to dock in Hodeidah port. We've discussed that issue with our guests at the News Review program.
Now, Yemen's petroleum company has slammed Saudi Arabia for its refusal to allow three ships carrying fuel to dock in the port of Hodeidah. In a statement, the company says a Saudi-led coalition seized the tankers nearly 3 months ago, despite the vessels having secured UN clearance for sailing in international waters. It says the country is in need of fuel to continue its public services. Yemen has been mired in war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia since 2015. War has killed tens of thousands of people and has destroyed Yemen's vital infrastructure. UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, calling the situation there the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Now, joining us for our News Review program, meanwhile, is Kevin Barrett, author, Middle East Affairs expert from Madison, Wisconsin, and E. Michael Jones, editor at Culture Wars Online Magazine from South Bend. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Dr. Barrett, we'll start with you, your initial thoughts on what's going on with Yemen. And the Saudis are doing, it goes beyond the scope of war. These are actually against the rules of engagement to deal with anything that has to do with something that may impact food, fuel, medicine, civilian population. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, they're blockading fuel. And that is part of what keeps a country going and allows the civilian population to stay alive. So this is a war crime. It's also completely un-Islamic. The Islamic tradition strongly discourages boycotts. In fact, some interpretations say that one should not even boycott the enemy during wartime. One should be open to trading even with the enemy. And certainly, the starving of civilians through these kinds of sanctions is horrific. And whether you're judging it by international law, Islamic morality, or common human decency, and the Saudis are one of the world's biggest arms spenders. They have military weapons of all kinds, much of which they're not even competent to use, but they're not actually fighting fair here. They're fighting people who are grossly underarmed, and they're attacking the entire civilian population. And this is, of course, counterproductive. It's driving the Yemeni people into a ever stronger mode of resistance to this Saudi oppression. So the international community is still going along with this. The Saudis have so much money, they throw it around and bribe leaders from so many different countries, including the U.S., and now they're in bed with the Israelis, which gives them even more power in the Zionist-occupied West. So it's a scandal, it's disgusting, and the suffering people of Yemen deserve a lot better.
Thank you, sir. Mr. E. Michael Jones, welcome to the program. Always a pleasure to hear from you, sir. Your thoughts on Saudi Arabia? I mean, what did the Saudis get out of denying the civilian population fuel in Yemen? What did the Saudis get from denying the people fuel?
They get it from the Americans and from the British. It's very simple. The conduct of World War II by the Allies was an attack on the civilian population. It was war crimes from beginning to end. The British inaugurated this attack. They had planned it earlier in the 1930s. Ever since the British had airplanes, they would use it to terrorize civilian populations. And by the time of World War II broke out, they had plenty of airplanes. And they would systematically bomb German cities. The Americans joined in, and you had colossal war crimes of the sort of the firebombing of Dresden, the firebombing of Hamburg. Dresden was full of refugees. No one knows how many people died there. This is the legacy of World War II. and the Pax, the misnamed Pax Americana is, it should be Bellum Americana. This is the Anglo-American way of waging war. You attack the civilian population. And it especially fits in with the Saudis because they have, as Kevin pointed out, they have lots of weapons and no army. They probably can't even use these weapons. So it lends itself to this type of attack on a civilian population instead of a straight military engagement.
And Dr. Barrett, when you do go after a civilian population and basically dish out collective punishment on them, whatever makes you think that ultimately you'll be able to insert a puppet regime there in Sana'a?
Well, this is counterproductive militarily. There's an interesting book by, I believe it's Caleb Carr, C-A-R-R, analyzing terrorism historically. And attacking civilian population is the definition of terrorism. And historically, it's often been counterproductive. That is, when the Roman Empire overdid its butchery of the civilian population among the so-called barbarian Germanic tribes, they remembered, and their children remembered, and generations remembered, and hated Rome, and that's one reason that Rome fell and was overrun by these various peoples, and this has been going on ever since. And so today, as the Saudis are butchering the people of Yemen, cutting them off from fuel and medicine, dropping bombs from high, safe altitudes, and waging this disgusting war, which, as Dr. Jones correctly says, is a continuation of the methods of war of the Anglo-Zionist Empire, they are angering that population even more and stiffening its resolve. The same has happened in Palestine, where the Zionist occupiers have been so atrocious in their war on the civilian population of Palestine, perpetrating what Francis Boyle has called genocide by all measures of international law, that the Palestinian people have stiffened their resolve and are still there resisting after all of these decades. So war on civilian populations is not a very good idea. The Americans learned it in Vietnam. They just learned it in Afghanistan. The Saudis are learning it, but they're not learning it fast enough, and the human suffering that's entailed is catastrophic.
Gentlemen, thank you both, and stay safe. Thanks. It's always a pleasure to check in with both of you. Dr. Kevin Barrett there joining us from Madison, Wisconsin, and Dr. E. Michael Jones from South Bend joining us, editor from Culture Wars Online magazine.
And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat Obad 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
As for the issue of economy, culture, cyberspace, diplomacy and the like, there are some points that cannot be explained in detail in this meeting. Later on, if there is an opportunity, God willing, and if I live long enough, I will raise certain points. In the present time, there are certain economic problems in the country. The high rate of inflation is one of the major problems. And other problems include budget deficiency, the livelihood, condition of people with low incomes. These are the important problems, as well as the devaluation of national currency. This is one of the issues which makes one really embarrassed. We could equally mention a reduction in the people's purchasing power and the problems in the trade and business environment. Despite the fact that we and officials of economic matters have placed so much emphasis on this matter, there are problems in the area of the business environment. We could also refer to the problems with the banking system. These are the economic problems of the country. There are other problems as well, for each of which we should have plans and work hard, because resolving these matters is important.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A fundamental point is that our economists and our officials of economic matters in this administration should work in harmony in resolving these problems. An important example of the solidarity mentioned before could be applied here. In other words, they should come to agreement about these important economic matters and work in harmony. Mr. President mentioned the first vice president, Mr. Mukhbir, is in charge of coordination. This is a very important task. It is very important. There should be coordination in economic areas. I hope that this responsibility will be carried out perfectly, inshallah, God willing. If there is disagreement, I strongly advise you gentlemen not to discuss it among the people. This is because when a disagreement on economy is discussed in public, it will show its real impact in the business environment.
in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Taiwan is an island in East Asia which has been self-ruled since 1950. The People's Republic of China regards it as a breakaway region that must one day be reunited with the mainland. Beijing has never ruled out the use of force to bring the island under its control. The situation has become very tense since President Tsai Ing-wen came into office in 2016. She has said Taiwan is independent and not part of China. The United States and some of its European allies have been expanding their relations with Taiwan despite Chinese opposition. The Chinese government has been angered by the growing trade and military ties between the West and Taiwan. In response to the West's growing support for the island, China has been flexing its military muscles in the region. Tensions escalated this week between the U.S. and China over Taiwan after America's top general signaled that America stands ready to intervene if a conflict erupts in the region. U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley said the U.S. military absolutely could defend Taiwan from a potential Chinese attack if asked to do so. How far is the United States really willing to go over Taiwan? Will it be ready to confront another nuclear-armed superpower, given all the risks and possible costs involved, where success is not guaranteed at all?
This sounds very much like typical political positioning before some sort of a negotiation. The United States certainly does not have any positive interest in making a war over Taiwan, except, of course, to sell weapons and to spend taxpayers' money.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said on Thursday that, quote, the negative and erroneous words and deeds of the U.S. related to the Taiwan question have encouraged the blatancy of the Taiwan secessionists. He also blamed Washington for the increasing tension across the Taiwan Strait. Beijing has reiterated that the issue of Taiwan is a red line that must not be crossed, but the West seems to be determined to challenge China. This week, the European Parliament's first official delegation to the island said Taiwan is not alone and called for measures to bolster EU-Taiwan ties. Beijing condemned the trip, urging the European side to correct its mistakes and not send any wrong signals to Taiwan, warning that it will harm China-EU relations. Where does Europe really stand on this issue?
The Europeans are typically following Germany and making supportive sounds in the support of U.S. foreign policy, but are not prepared to physically become engaged, especially after the debacle in Afghanistan. So I would suggest that we can call the European comments on this topic chatter on the line. In other words, a background noise that's not critical to the situation.
The EU seems to be following policies close to those of the U.S. The West knows all too well that China is highly unlikely to back down on the issue of Taiwan. Why is it then being so provocative? Is it trying to create a conflict in the region close to China's borders? The U.S. has been selling many billions of dollars worth of weapons to the self-ruled island. And U.S. President Joe Biden has made no secret of his priority to contain China's influence. This leaves little doubt that Taiwan will remain a very serious bone of contention between the two sides for years to come.
forces of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, have managed to thwart an attempt by the United States to take over a giant oil tanker in the strategic sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, intended to unload the shipment to another tanker and then direct it to an unknown destination. But IRGC forces reacted promptly and carried out a heli-borne operation on the stolen ship's deck, gained control of the vessel, and directed it back toward Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces then proceeded to chase the tanker using several helicopters and warships, but their attempt at taking over the vessel for a second time was thwarted again by Iranian naval forces. The tanker is currently in Iranian territorial waters and under the protection of IRGC's Navy.
The United States continues to use oil and weaponize oil against Iran because it has not been able to overthrow the Iranian Islamic Revolution in any other way.
Iran has repeatedly warned the U.S. about its military adventurism in the Persian Gulf. Tehran says it has increased its patrols to secure the passage of Iranian ships and to combat fuel smuggling in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
The U.S. will try to provoke some sort of conflict in the Persian Gulf because of this, and we have to keep this in mind because the Persian Gulf belongs to Iran and the people of the Middle East, not the United States. The United States should not be there to begin with.
Iranian officials say U.S. military presence in the region is a source of instability and insecurity. Iran believes the countries of the region are fully capable of providing their own security. The latest confrontation between the U.S. and Iran comes amid rising bilateral and regional tensions.
The United States continues its presence in the Persian Gulf because it is a key geopolitical trade route. Most of the energy, commerce, petroleum, commodities that are exchanged on the global market are done so in the Persian Gulf, because if we look geographically at a map, the Persian Gulf connects trade in Europe across Egypt through the Suez Canal and leads into the Indian Ocean.
Washington has tried to disrupt the legitimate oil trade of Iran with other countries. The U.S. has threatened Iran over its fuel deliveries to Lebanon and Venezuela. It believes that the sanctions it has imposed on Iran should be adhered by Iran under its so-called maximum pressure campaign. But this is a campaign that has failed, even admitted by some U.S. officials. Tensions have risen between Iran and the U.S. after the U.S. pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal as part of a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The campaign included tough economic sanctions combined with credible military threat. Washington's European allies failed to live up to their commitments.
For many years, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the United States, Washington, London, the Western imperialist powers have done everything they can to try to overthrow the popular revolution, the government.
The administration of U.S. President Biden says it wants to rejoin the deal, but at the same time, it is pressing ahead with failed maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has also said in a tweet that the talks to remove sanctions on Iran would fail unless U.S. President Joe Biden could guarantee that Washington would not renege on the nuclear agreements in the future.
And the U.S. maintains its presence in the Persian Gulf because it sees that Iran has been able to withstand so many imperialist attacks, and also that Iran has many friends around the world. Let's recall just a few weeks ago in the lead up to this piracy by the U.S. that Iran was able to successfully bring petroleum refineries to the nation of Venezuela.
Now talks have been set to resume on November 29th, but the talks are aimed at removing illegal U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran. That is Iran's approach towards the talks. Only time will tell whether the U.S. will remove the sanctions or that the talks will fail.
November 2nd marks the anniversary of declaration that proved disastrous to the Palestinian people. The Balfour Declaration is named after Lord Arthur Balfour, the then British Foreign Secretary who penned the document. The Balfour Declaration was a public statement issued by the UK government during World War I, announcing support for the creation of Israel. Palestinians view the declaration as a prelude to the Israeli occupation of their homeland in 1948, saying the UK government should apologize for issuing the document. The war leading to Israel's creation caused some 750,000 Palestinians either to flee or being expelled from their homes in what they call the Nakba or catastrophe. The British allowed the Jews to establish self-governing institutions, such as the Jewish Agency, while the Palestinians were forbidden from doing so, paving the way for the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine.
It's absolutely the source of the conflict. People who pretend that the deterioration began in 1967 with Israel's conquest of the West Bank and Gaza are deluding themselves. Zionism was a colonizing project which set out to establish a Jewish majority to remove as many Palestinians as they possibly could.
Emboldened by the Balfour Declaration and the ensuing Western support, Israel captured huge swathes of Arab land in a war in 1948 and then proclaimed its existence. In 1967, it proceeded to capture more Palestinian territory in another war. It then started propping up scores of settlements across that occupied territory in a move to gradually annex it. Tel Aviv has defied all international condemnations of its settlement activities, including outright denunciation by the United Nations.
And because Zionism is a system of Jewish supremacy over Palestinians across the whole of Palestine, the Zionists came to Palestine not to live alongside the Palestinians, not to be immigrants like in a normal country, but to displace the Palestinians. So yes, the problem is Zionism, and until the Zionist program of colonization and dispossession is ended, there's no possibility of a resolution to the crisis.
There are a set of reasons over which there is a general consensus about why Britain issued the Balfour Declaration. Control over Palestine was a strategic imperial interest to keep Egypt and the Suez Canal within Britain's sphere of influence. Britain sided with the Zionists to rally support among Jews in the United States and Russia, hoping they could encourage their governments to stay in the war until victory. There was also intense Zionist lobbying and strong connections between the Zionist community in Britain and the British government. Some of the officials in the government were Zionists themselves. While Britain is generally held responsible for the Balfour Declaration, it is important to note that the statement would not have been made without prior approval from the other Allied powers during World War I.
Colonialism was substantially rolled back and defeated in the 50s and 60s and 70s with independence for countries in Africa and Asia. So the Israeli project is an anachronism. It's out of time. It flies in the face of the laws that were passed in Nuremberg after the Second World War against the conquest of territory by force and the dispossession of the natives. But the Palestinians don't seem to be protected by that law.
In 1917, British ministers decided that the views of U.S. President Wilson should be obtained before any declaration was made. According to documents, the ministers recalled Arthur Balfour, confirming that Wilson was extremely favorable to the movement. France was also involved and announced its support prior to the issuing of the Balfour Declaration. A May 1917 letter from Jules Cambon, a French diplomat, to Nahum Sokolow, a Polish Zionist, expressed the sympathetic views of the French government towards, quote, Jewish colonization in Palestine.
The United Kingdom and France have gotten into a bitter diplomatic row. The two countries have been at odds over post-Brexit fishing rights in the British territorial waters. The UK gives out licenses to foreign vessels wishing to fish in its waters, But Paris says some fishing boats have been denied permission to enter areas they have fished in for years. London says the licenses have been distributed according to the post-Brexit deal it reached with the European Union last December. The dispute escalated to the point where a British trawler was seized by French officials, prompting the UK to summon Paris's ambassador in London, a move that's usually made against enemies and not allies. Paris threatened London with sanctions if the issue isn't resolved by the 2nd of November. The UK Foreign Secretary launched a counterattack against France, vowing legal action if Paris doesn't back down.
It's unclear, it's always unclear as to who's correct or incorrect, but usually they are resolved in a peaceful, diplomatic manner. But we live in an age of a growing nationalism, in which international institutions are breaking down. And so as a result, a minor spat over fishing rights is turning into a major international crisis.
Threats have raised concerns about a larger trade dispute between two of Europe's largest economies. The fishing issue was one of the key points dragging the Brexit talks. Although fishing constitutes a small portion of France and Britain's economies, it holds substantial political significance as it's the main lifeline for the coastal communities. Apart from the fishing disputes, the two countries have recently clashed over the AUKUS agreement, under which Australia ditched a multi-billion dollar submarine deal with France for a similar one with the US and UK.
So it's the French were appalled, extremely angry by America's peremptory behavior, and they are looking for a way of striking back. And Boris Johnson didn't make things any better by taunting the French when the AUKUS alliance became news, by taunting them in the crudest schoolboy manner.
Britain's departure from the EU has also negatively affected its economy. Official data forecast a 4% economic slowdown for the country in the long run in the aftermath of its exit from the bloc, while the COVID-19 impact is estimated to cut Britain's gross domestic product by 2%. Brexit also cast doubts on the future of the 1998 Irish peace deal, as it would mean a hard border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the EU. Although the two sides settled the issue, the agreement that has been implemented since January this year has led to the disruption of trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, causing disagreements between London and Brussels. The UK government now wants the deal rewritten. Experts believe the long lines and brawls at the fuel stations across Britain are going to be the new normal for life in the post-Brexit UK.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Choo choo kachoo, it's the Youth Station for you. I'm your host, Mudaffar Haider, and here in the studio we have...
Mehdi.
Yeah, Brother Mehdi Najafi. Are you from Najaf?
I am not from Najaf.
That makes sense, then. how did you get the name
Because of my
Najafi?
Father. He was there for 30 years or something. That's why he was named. It's called Nisbi.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, we're all kind of Qumi now, aren't we?
Yeah.
Nobody calls us Qumi because everybody around us are Qumis as well.
So yeah, when you leave that place, you're affiliated that place because you came from that place.
Yeah.
And once you leave that place to another place, that's when you call that.
Do you believe in karma?
Do I believe in karma? I do believe in karma.
So we live in this kind of world of pseudo-spiritualism, of meditation, of Buddhist, Hindu ideologies, kind of interwoven into modern society. And so we have lots of these kinds of ideas propping up all over the place in videos online and in movies and in sitcoms. You hear this word thrown around quite a bit, karma. And the basic idea is that if you give good, good will come back to you. If you give evil, evil will come back to you. Now, basically, is there a premise for this in Islamic thought?
There certainly is, right? It might not be exactly how it's seen in the world these days. For example, every action has it comes back to you sooner or later, right? So sooner or later. By later we mean
could be the dunya, could be akhirah.
Could be the akhirah. Mm-hmm. But you know, then again, dunya and akhirah is simultaneous. It's not something that's akhirah is right now. We do not perceive it.
Yeah.
So in that sense, yeah, karma isn't what goes Islam. It's not what you do comes back to you. It's what you do is there.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Like, there is no coming back to you. It does come back to you. In your life, you'd see certain things that that happen to you, right, instantaneously as a result of your good or bad doing. Besides that, it's right there. When you do something, good or bad, it comes back to you. Fair enough. You might see it or you might not see it. Besides that, what you do, positive or negative, has formed something, right? It has formed something, and it's instantaneous. Can we head for a break so I can?
Oh, you need a break?
Yeah, I need a break.
All right, yeah, no, that's fine. We'll come back after a break then. Welcome back to the show. We've been discussing about karma. There's a beautiful hadith, right, where the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, he goes to Mi'raj, you know, the nightly ascent of the Prophet. He goes into the other realm and he actually sees and he witnesses what no other human or jinn has ever seen before. And he saw the realm of the angels, and he sees that the angels are building these magnificent towers and these castles and these beautiful structures. And every once in a while, they stop building, and then they start building again, and then they stop building, and then they start building. So the Holy Prophet asks Jibreel, alayhi salam, why are they stopping and starting? So he has answered that every time a mu'min is doing the dhikr of Allah, these angels gain the materials to build with, and so they build. But whenever he stops remembering Allah, whenever he stops doing the dhikr of Allah, they don't get those materials. And so they are not building anymore. Imam Khomeini, I believe, explains this. And he says, just like you just said, we are constantly crafting our hereafter. Here and now, we are making and forging our hereafter with every one of our actions.
Yeah, well, that's put much better than...
You just couldn't find an example, but example came to my mind.
That's precisely it, yeah.
Now, when it comes to karma, I feel like the big problem that exists in this idea that, you know, good, you give a little bit of love, it all comes back to you. You give some hatred, it will come back to you. There is a reality behind it, but I do feel that a lot of people in the modern world have limited it so severely to this dunya then they will never understand the greater scope of what we're talking about. Your soul is infinite, like Imam Ali alayhi salam said, you know.
Yeah.
He said, you know, your
like, it's good that you mentioned the soul, because if you want results, instant results, they're there. In the soul, in your own soul, they're there, right? They might not be material, right? Because the soul isn't material. But what you do good, there's another point over here. In Islam, what you do good, the good that you do, isn't so good, or isn't the pure good if it involves showing off, for example, mm-hmm. right? If it involves a secret benefit that you're after, right? A worldly benefit. For example, mm-hmm. I want people to think that I'm a generous person, and I show off giving off my money, and I go on Instagram or YouTube and film videos and
stuff like that. Unfortunately, our good deeds are completely impure. Many of them, most of 99% probably,
yeah. Well, Allah is generous, and He does reward us for certain things, right? Mm. Besides, despite the fact that they're impure.
Mm.
But pure deeds, the good deeds, have an instant effect on our soul. It grows our soul, right? And that, it's like working out.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's a good example, working out. You go to the gym, you work out, right? Are the effects instant? Yes. Instantly, you do. But are you going to be, if you're a slim man like me, are you going to be buff overnight? No.
No.
Right?
No.
But are the effects
of that? I feel
your
pain, by the way.
Yeah, you know, same man, yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that, you know? You have to work out for years to be shredded, as they call it. But what I'm saying is, but that one session of workout, were the effects instant? Yeah, they were instant, right? For that workout, that one workout, the effects that workout had to put out, that one session, those effects were instant.
Right.
But they're not so drastic that you see yourself or, you know, gaining weights overnight, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the same with the soul, right? Whatever I do positive, is it going to have an effect on my soul? Instantly, yes. Is it going to be tangible right then and there? No.
All right, I'm going to ask you to just hold that thought. We're going to come right back after a break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back to the show. We've been talking about karma. The soul does not perceive that which is hidden of the bounties of Allah, which He is actually providing for us. They're here already for us, but we don't perceive it. We're actually blind right now, and that's something that's always...
In the Quran. That's also in the Quran.
Right. You can't... I can't remember...
Basaruka al-yawma hadid. You know, like it says... on the day of judgment, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when all the material veils are gone, that's when Allah's going to be like, now you can really see.
Yeah,
you know?
That's
when we aren't...
I mean, that's a different discussion. I would love to discuss that, because that is really fascinating. I think we've really underestimated what the day of judgment really is. It really is the day where you can see everything clearly. Whereas right now, the life that we're living is the night. It's dark. You can't see. Even when you look in the mirror, you don't know what's inside your own soul. You don't know how good or bad you really are.
Mm.
It's terrifying, actually. I don't know. I don't know who you are right now. I don't know if you're a... with all due respect, I'm saying this generally. I don't know if you're a believer or a kafir. You could be like the most despicable person in the world just pretending to be good.
Even myself, I could disgust myself.
Yeah,
like, you know, if I realize
I could just be
to scare out.
I could be full of fire right now. But then on the other side, you know, we have to look at the positives too. You could be like an awliya Allah, and I don't even know it.
And that's one of the things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has hidden amongst in the earth, right?
But Allah anyway, coming back to the thing now.
Yeah.
I've always contemplated about this verse, which we often recite. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we generally say this verse when we're faced with some sort of calamity, when somebody dies or something terrible happens. But I want to contemplate on it through the context of this discussion, which is about karma. So Allah is basically saying here, me and you, humans, we are Allah's, and to Allah we will return.
Mm-hmm. No.
I'm going to... Yeah, go on.
We are returning.
We are returners. Whatever the case, it's we are returning, we are returning to Allah. But the idea is that we were created by Allah, and then we're returning to Him. So the underlying premise here...
And the question is, you return when you leave the place, right?
But we never left.
Yeah, why is it so? Anyway,
because but the idea is, whenever something is created, it returns to the source of its creation.
Oh.
Right? Okay, so Allah has created us.
Nice.
And then we create. We create children, or we create words. We create ideas when we're speaking. When we do good actions, we're actually creating those. Allah has given us the power to create temporarily. And eventually, you know those dolls, the Russian dolls? Then there's a big one, and then out of the big one comes a smaller one, and out of the smaller one comes an even
Chinese
smaller
or
one.
Russian?
Russian, Chinese dolls? Okay. Those dolls, everybody knows what those are, right? Yeah. But the idea is that it's kind of like that. So everything will return back to the bigger doll eventually. Not to make Allah something physical, God forbid, He's not physical. But the idea is we are returning. But that which we create will return to us, and then we will return to our parents and their parents, and then they will return to Allah. Okay. So coming back to this idea now, when you say something or you do something good, you've just created a good deed, and that will come back to you. What do you think of that?
That's well put. That's beautifully put. We do need to explain, because I don't understand what we mean by coming back to.
Uh-huh.
What does that mean? Like, what do you mean when you say it comes back to you? Like, how does it come back to you? A good deed, for example, how does it come back to you?
Well, the thing about energy is, if we look at things as everything is energy, which it's not, because there are things which are outside of energy, but if we just for a moment look at everything as energy, one of the principles that we learn about energy is it never disappears. It just changes forms.
Yeah, it never...
Right?
It's never
so
destroyed.
It will change forms, but it will come back to you in a different form. Well, that's all we have time for. I wish we could discuss this more. That was interesting, and we've just been discussing about the concept of karma, the Islamic side of it, the secular side of it. Yeah, and we hope that, you know, you've enjoyed our words, and that you too will return to us here on IRIB English Radio, inshallah.
Oh, slick.
Exclusively, yeah.
Yeah, well,
get
all of it.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have.